This is an oral history interview with Dr. Robert Brown, Space Telescope Project Scientist. It's the 7th of June, and we're in Dr. Brown's office at Marshall Space Flight Center. Interviewer is Joe Todorovic, and it's 9:10 in the morning. Okay, if you want to...
Well, why don't you go ahead with your questions?
Okay, fine. One of the things that I wanted to pick up, which comes from the last interview, is the activity on the planetary target implementation team.
Yes.
We last time talked a little bit about your realization that ST and the ground system as presently configured while you were at the Institute would not be able to do what it was supposed to do, which is to track planets and be able to track specific portions of planetary bodies with all the incumbent motions. We got last time more or less past your submission of a review item discrepancy and the lack of action on that. And I was wondering if we could pick up from there.
Sure. First of all, when the problem was first identified, there were shortcomings in both the flight and the ground segments. In other words, the project had not done any evaluation of what combination of capabilities would be needed for planetary targets. So the immediate review item discrepancy was submitted against the SOGS design in the fall of 1982. And at that time, we had not begun work on the flight segment component of it, although that now is really in quite good shape. And we can come back to that in a few minutes. That was handled in a different way because the flight segment was never open to the kind of design review and requirements review that the ground system was. So it ended up being worked in a different way.
Now the flight segment meaning some sort of algorithm in the onboard
computer. Meaning some capability in the flight software in this case that would allow the pointing control system to respond to the motion of a moving target. The review item discrepancies submitted to Goddard at the SOGS PDR basically went nowhere. It was generally agreed that these that they were with merit, but Goddard parried them in the following way. They simply put them on hold or on the back burner and did nothing about them, saying that the whole topic was under review, and that they it was not within their scope, or they did not wish to single out the ground system component of the problem and work it separately.
Okay, who would this have been?
Okay, that was I guess it's Wayne Hembree, who at that time was the SOGS manager mm-hmm. at Goddard. So repeatedly over the next months, I would, you know, in either by calling him directly after a certain time or whenever I saw him or whenever I saw other Goddard people who should know the status of that particular grid, I would, you know, inquire, well, how is it going on that, or what work is being planned in response to that? And always I was told, well, basically nothing's being done. The whole thing is being reevaluated. I continued to press this point in all available arenas. That includes, for example, there was a presentation to the Science Working Group. There was a standard presentation of the problem that I did give to the Science Working Group, and then also repeated several times in other forums, including one to the Goddard middle-level project staff. You know, people were aware that it was a problem, and I was the sort of the continuity in it. I would repeatedly point out to people in sort of cartoon-like detail the kind of the nature of the problem and the systems that it would affect, because even at that time the nature of the architectural impact on the ground system was pretty clear. And that really, I don't mean to make it sound as though it was a huge structural change. It involved primarily enhancements to the OSS real-time system that would allow a planetary scientist to interact with an acquisition image, because that's the key change. Because of the timing involved and the rates of motion and the uncertainties associated with the positions of guide stars, with respect to the absolute system of planetary ephemerides, it's necessary to take an acquisition image as a bootstrap in the pointing.
So this would involve the ability of somebody sitting at one of the display consoles to actually use that, to have the information displayed in a reasonable form for them to use and input hardware and software?
What you need is, let's say for example you want to take a spectrum of a particular cloud formation on Jupiter.
Okay.
Well, we're talking about pointing that is, the requirement on the pointing is that you be able to place that small science instrument aperture onto that feature with 2 or 3 hundredths of an arc second accuracy, depending on its relative motion, and if it were Jupiter, it would be 2 hundredths of an arc second. What you need to do is to take a picture first of the planet with, say, the wide field planetary camera. And that requires rather coarse pointing. Obviously, all you need to do is to get Jupiter within the field of view of the camera. And then once you have that picture, then you have at that moment in time the exact relationship between the planetary field, points in the planetary field, and the spacecraft coordinates, that is to say, points on the focal plane of the telescope. In other words, before the picture was taken, you were uncertain as to where the planet would appear at the arc second level of uncertainty. Due to the fact that the guide star, the absolute ephemerides and the guide star relative coordinates are uncertain to the arc second level. But once you've taken a picture, that picture was obtained locked onto guide stars, and you have the image of the planet, so you've established, in a working sense, the relationship. Now all that's required is to take the information that is in that picture, which shows the mapping of the planetary field onto the focal plane of the telescope, to extract from that the right information to be able to then do a delta pointing, a offset pointing, that would be exactly that required to take a point in the picture, in the planetary, a point represented in the picture from the planetary field, and offset that a definite amount on the focal plane and put it in the spectrograph aperture for subsequent guiding.
Okay, so in the case of a planet which is not rotating rapidly, what you've got is a point on the planetary disk which you can then keep the instrument pointed at.
Yeah, and even if it is rotating, then you need, then the information is presumably present in that picture plus in your homework to be able to predict the subsequent motion from the time the picture was taken, so that all, even planetocentric motions, can be accounted for in the offset and other and pointing commands associated with putting that thing on the spectrograph aperture and then tracking it with the spectrograph aperture.
Existing planetary ephemerides and planetocentric ephemerides are accurate enough so that one wide-field planetary camera picture in which you can derive at that moment the relationship between planetary coordinates and the focal plane. They're accurate enough that you can then dead reckon.
They would. From that. They are normally accurate enough. The only case in which they would not be sufficiently accurate is in the case of, and I'm trying hard to think of an example, a case where you couldn't necessarily predict the motion. I frankly can't think of an example, but it might occur in a if there were a very rapidly moving cloud formation on some planet. That was I don't honestly think there is a case where the some uncertainty in the wind speed or something could actually produce observable error during an observing session. But that's the kind of case it could be. If there was a north-south wind on Jupiter that was sufficient to and random that it could do that, then that's a case where you wouldn't have enough information and you might wish to take two pictures to see to get your best estimate of what the motion was. But I'm not sure that in actual fact there would be that set might in fact be a null set. Let me point out what you need from that picture is you need to identify the target. That is to say, you need to point at the thing and say, that's what I want to study. And point to it, I mean, with a cursor or something. You need to be able to look on the picture and see what your target is, or be able to do that using the information on the picture. Secondly, you need to be able to predict the future motion, the future apparent motion of that target. And as we said last time, the apparent motion includes several components. Let me point out that two of them are known in advance and are taken care of. By the time you've taken the acquisition image, they've already been taken care of, and they will be in the science observation also. Those two components are, number one, the apparent motion due to heliocentric motions, both of the Earth and of the planet. You needed that information not to blur the picture.
Right.
And that's straightforward. You can get that out of the ephemeris. What you couldn't get was the absolute position, but you can get the apparent motion very accurately out of the ephemeris. The second component is the one due to parallax of the ST orbit. In other words, as you go around, you get a stereo view of the planets, and they appear to move. Now, that one is also known very accurately in advance and is accommodated on the ST in an onboard parallax correction. In other words,
the parallax database for the ST orbital motion is contained on board.
That's right.
And not in the ground system.
It is in both places. Mm-hmm. But there is every couple of days an update that is sent up to the spacecraft computer, which is a representation of the ST orbit. It's the ST orbital ephemeris. And it is maintained by tracking data out of the TDRS system, ranging data out of the telemetry stream. And the OSCF, which is what orbital support control center, I'm not sure just what it is. Anyway, those are the orbit people. And it's their responsibility to analyze these are not in the project. This is a NASA facility or NASA office, and I think it may be at Goddard. The OSCF has the responsibility of looking at the telemetry data, deriving an ephemeris, what's called definitive orbit for the past, sending over basically where the thing was in the past, and then providing predictions into the future that are then are superseded by subsequent ones, but they remain valid for a few days. And there is a requirement, a current requirement on that system that process maintain the on-orbit ephemeris to better than 10 kilometers RMS accuracy in the key dimension, which is the in-track error, that is along the orbit.
Right.
Okay. And so the OSCF provides ephemeris information to pass the system in the POC, which maintains the Payload Operation Control Center. The PASS system is the payload application software system that is meant to receive that information from the OSCF, package it in the appropriate way, and send it up and maintain the onboard orbit ephemeris.
Right, because they're supporting TDRS acquisitions, they're supporting other Earth-orbiting spacecraft.
The OSCF.
The OSCF at Goddard is supporting a whole range of
right.
of people, and you're one customer.
That's right.
In a sense.
That's right. That's right.
That
and we get our orbit from them. Okay, so that information goes up, and along with it goes up information about the range to the target, and its position. That is to say, if I'm studying Jupiter, the right ascension and declination and radial distance. Actually, it's a heliocentric. I think it's a heliocentric formulation in this ephemeris capability on orbit, so that you send up the heliocentric. I believe you send up the heliocentric radius of the target.
That and would you, make and sense.
And then we know where the Earth is, and then we know where the ST is around the Earth, and the onboard ephemeris does the trigonometry to show to know with respect to the guide stars what the apparent motion of something there in the foreground is going to be. And so the on-orbit ephemeris gives the parallax correction. Now, one shortcoming in the on-orbit ephemeris is that it only retains, I think, corrections for eccentricity in the target orbit through second order in the eccentricity. And so for something like Halley's Comet, which is very highly eccentric, the on-orbit ephemeris for that target is going to be the most nearly circular orbit or slightly eccentric orbit that describes it. And so there will be error terms. And so one of the developments in the ground system that will be necessary is to absorb those errors into the third capability that we haven't talked about to compensate what would normally be planetocentric components of the motion. But in other words, what I've talked about so far are the capabilities for compensating the heliocentric orbital motions, which is basically straight line motion. Mm-hmm. The parallax motion through the on-orbit thing. And then there's a third capability that we haven't discussed that's able to absorb all the additional components of the motion, primarily planetocentric, but also any residual errors in the parallax correction for highly eccentric orbits could be absorbed in that capability also. Mm-hmm. So, let's see. Tell me where we were.
Okay.
We were talking about why we needed to take this picture, and
right.
we were talking about the different components of the motion in it, and I said that in order to be able to do that offset and subsequent tracking to take the spectrum, say, of a feature in that picture, you needed to know all the subsequent apparent motions of that thing,
mm-hmm.
and two of them are already in the system at the time you've taken the picture.
Right.
That's the parallax and the heliocentric orbiting. Now, if you're just interested in, say, a satellite or the limb of the planet or something that doesn't have a complicated planetocentric motion or one that you could have predicted in advance, and you would have already absorbed into the planning process, then you don't need to do any more work. But if you have to study, say, a cloud on the face of Jupiter, or an aurora on the face of a planet, or a dust storm on Mars, or something that you do not know in advance exactly where on the disk it's going to occur, or where in the planetary field it's going to occur, then you are also uncertain about what its apparent motion is. The reason is that orbiting motion and rotational motion require that you know the longitude and latitude, say, of the target. Mm-hmm. That is to say, something that is at 85 degrees north latitude on Jupiter, its rotational motion is less than something on the equator.
Right.
And furthermore, on the plane of the sky, its two-dimensional motion on the plane of the sky will depend on where it is with respect to the central meridian.
Yeah, so you've got spin axis of the planet, you've got the aspect, you've got all of these things which are fairly well known, but
you've got still you, have yeah, to be you know that you know the spin axis, you know the rotation rate, mm-hmm. and on Jupiter, the rotation rate will in fact vary with latitude, but you know pretty much what it is
yeah.
as a function of latitude, and so, in the case of a feature on a planetary disk, you will need not only to pick out where that target is at that moment, you also need to derive from that acquisition image the longitude and latitude of the feature, and longitude with respect to the central meridian, so that then you can use that information. That's the only additional information you need to be able to predict how it's going to move in the future. Okay, now in order to be able to derive the planetocentric coordinates of the feature, you need to either figuratively or literally impress on that image a grid of planetocentric coordinates. That is to say, you need to at least have the information that would allow you to put up lines of longitude and latitude onto the picture.
Right. Now, the International Planetary Patrol Project at Lowell, Bill Baum was kind of working backwards, in the sense that he would had a device that would project a photograph that was taken of Mars by one of the International Patrol cameras, and then he had a series of acetate grids, depending on location, the central meridian, season, and aspect of the apparent aspect of the rotation axis. He would select the appropriate grid, slap it on top, and then read off
right.
the planetocentric coordinates of that feature, which
right.
he did not know in advance.
Right.
In a sense,
that's the same process, and what you need to do in this case is you ultimately want the computer to read off the planetocentric coordinates, so then it can go away and, given all that information, predict the future motion. The important step is the one that Bill probably did with his hands, and that is to slide that grid around until it fit onto the until it fit onto the thing, and there you've got not only translational degrees of freedom but rotational degrees of freedom. Okay, so what you need in effect is a number of strategies, some minimal number of strategies that would allow you to say run that cursor over and put it on two satellites, or do have a routine that would fit the limb of the planet, mm-hmm. and take into account its possibly crescent or not fully phase angle illumination,
right?
And determine enough points in that field, fiducial points in that field, so that then it could say, oh, so that's where things are. Now I know how to put down the mm-hmm. grid, and then, once that's done, and whether or not it actually involves a display of those coordinates or, you know, lines showing the limb or not, I suppose it would be nice to do so. Whether or not that step happens to reassure the observer it's been done correctly, what needs to go forward from that point is for the computers in the OSS to then take the previously identified target pixel
right.
and translate that into, run it through the now known transformation back to planetocentric coordinates and say, oh, that's at 50 degrees north latitude, it's 5 degrees east of the central meridian, and now knowing how the planet rotates, knowing its rotational speed, its future motion will be blah, blah, blah. And then now to take that information, now both the offset information from pixel to the spectrograph slit, which is the same even if that were a fixed target, and knowledge of the subsequent motion, the new knowledge, which is now complete knowledge given all the pre-planning mm-hmm. of the subsequent motion, to then what happens is that the information goes over to, is prepared in the OSS as a request for those pointing maneuvers. And that request goes to ports, the real-time system, and is formulated into a command load that then goes up and, first of all, offsets the telescope, initiates the new subsequent motion, and then would trigger the science instrument mm-hmm. Operations that would take a spectrum of that feature. Now, all that needs to be done with sufficient accuracy and also with sufficient timing, adequate timing. Notice that the timing is a little bit testing. The reason is that any time error you set up those commands to take place at a certain definite time. If they do not take place at that time, but you say are uncertain as to mm-hmm. when they'll be executed to within, say, a second, then that second of time times the apparent motion is a contributor to the pointing error.
And for something like Mars, fairly close in and fairly
rapid motion,
that can be very serious.
Yes, it can be. The overall RMS pointing error for planetary targets is either 0.03 or 0.02 seconds of arc RMS. And the typical apparent motions of, say, normal planets and not things like Earth-crossing asteroids and comets is something like 50 milliarc seconds per second. So that would tell you that you need to really have your things accurate to much less than half a second of time in the case of those planets in order for that not to be the big contributor to your right. Positional uncertainty. There are other contributions also. So at the, uh, 10 to 100 millisecond level is the range of absolute accuracy with which you need to execute commands to do the planetary problem adequately. And that isn't a particular problem. It just, everything needs to be planned so that it takes care of, so that it gets accomplished. Now let me try to say now about the, why it's my feeling that the major development is in the ground system and not in the, in adding additional, say, hardware capabilities. We've looked at the timing question. The capabilities are there in principle to do the timing adequately. Some time ago, we approached Lockheed and the Lockheed PCS people and explained to them, about the planetary problem and what we felt the requirements would be on the PCS system to be able to accomplish them, which is basically the ability to do curved motion in time mm-hmm. To take account for the planetocentric components of motion. And they went away and invented a new command called the 48 command, which is basically a five-term polynomial in time. From their point of view, it's in three orthogonal directions because they think in V1, V2, V3 coordinates, spacecraft coordinates. But in effect, it's the two coordinates on the plane of the sky that would describe, say, a smooth curve. And that's right. A curve that needs to be executed. Your position is a function of time, and what I'm saying is that they have formulated something that would allow you to take care of something that has up to five-term polynomial, basically, of curvature in time, which is completely adequate for the planetary
and
problem.
The roll axis of the spacecraft is then not involved.
It's not involved, and it shouldn't be involved. But it's their approach to the it's the way the PCS people think.
Right.
But that's also a degree of freedom.
Three
so,
axis, yeah.
And so you'd expect one of the polynomials not to have terms in it. It may be somewhere in the formulation you retransform things so that you have three fully rich polynomials. But in essence, the information is in two dimensions.
Who were the people at Lockheed? You mentioned a Tom Sherrill last time.
Tom Sherrill is not in the PCS group. He's in the Mission Operation Contractor group, the MOC group. He's been a key player on this problem. It's been very helpful. The people that worked on the PCS software, the key person there is Hugh Dougherty. He's basically the guru on the point and control system at Lockheed, and is personally responsible for much of the flight software.
Okay. Are there any? We're always looking for documentation for various things, and also it makes things easier. We can home in on important points to ask in interviews and so forth. Are there any minutes of meetings or paperwork documenting this kind of activity? That's my first question. And secondly, where are they and can I see them
absolutely.
At some point?
Absolutely. There was a presentation of the Science Working Group that would appear in the Science Working Group minutes.
Okay, which one was that? It wasn't last February, was it? Or it might have been the day that I was not there.
It was one in the... would have been in the 82-83 time frame.
I can find it. That's
right.
That's all.
Anyway,
it was
my first and only presentation of the Science Working Group during that period. In other words, I was invited by... Ricardo put me on the menu, basically, to go explain to the Science Working Group what was going on, and it was a meeting at Marshall.
Okay, now I can
and I think
find that.
You'll be able to find it, okay.
Yeah.
And as far as the RIDS go, has Goddard let you at the RIDS for the PDR?
We have had pretty well open access to the Goddard stuff. We haven't yet made our way into the RIDS. What we've got is they've now been moving offices around, and we've got a kind of a temporary office, and they moved our stuff around, and we haven't been out there in a week or two. But I can pretty well. One of the things I need to do is to find that RID. And find the associated actions on it. That should be fairly easy to do, since I know approximately the time that it was submitted from the last interview.
Right.
In the sequence of.
Okay.
Things.
Let me. Yeah. Go ahead.
So continuing just on the subject of documentation, there's your presentation to the Science Working Group, the RID that you submitted when you were at the Institute.
Yep. Okay, then there were numerous internal memos at the Science Institute that I can bring up, basically showing concepts and so forth. By the beginning of 1983, I would say that this was something that everyone knew had fallen through the cracks. In fact, I should pull out my... notes because let's see.
Okay. Could you just, for the sake of the tape, read what is on the front cover of that notebook, if you wouldn't mind? That is the very front cover. Just read what it says there, and that will identify.
This is a notebook of mine. It has my name and my institute address. It says. Has my secretary's name Jean underneath it with her extension 8650. The very first page in this is June 15th, 1982 is the date on it.
That's page number one.
That's page number one in the book. Okay. And it records an IDT meeting of the WFBIC at Dulles Airport on June 15th, 1982.
That's fine. Now, if you could just identify the page
Now, it's page 30 that I'm looking at the moment. And
thanks.
It's
a little bit of historical.
Right. On page 30, and it's September 22. 1982, the SOGS PDR, and I raised concerns on science data uncertainty, which is another topic. I think the data analysis system in the ST, end to end, and I'm speaking particularly about science data, has not ever treated. The question of uncertainties in a scientifically adequate way, and I raised concerns about that at the SOGS PDR. That's a problem. That's a battle that I would be happy to go on fighting, and I do so at any time I can, but it's a very unsophisticated approach to data analysis, and it's a serious deficiency in the system, in my opinion, but then I'm not one to be lecturing astronomers on how they should handle their data. We'll get into that topic some other time. But I have here, second paragraph, concerning planetary acquisitions. No consideration in SEO6. And SEO6 was the document under review at that time, if I'm not mistaken. The only way in which I could be in error is that might, instead of being the design document, it might be the requirements document. But in any case, that's a SOGS document, and I believe SEO6 is the document that was under review at the PDR.
Okay, great.
And Ed Groth came up to me after I raised the concern that the systems simply were not there to plan and schedule planetary acquisitions, and in particular, I could see that the OSS didn't have any tools for planetary targets, and basically nowhere in the system was any special capability for planetary targets. Ed Groth, who is the data and operations team leader, mm-hmm. Came up and said, it was overlooked. That's my line there. Bob Hobbs came up to me. Hobbs is a contractor, and I'm not sure what company he was with, but basically he was doing, that company was doing piecework for TRW. Scenario.
For the SOGS?
For the SOGS people. In other words, he wasn't with TRW, but he was with a company that was basically producing observational scenarios and helping them sort of with in-depth mm-hmm. Studies in support of SOGS development at TRW. And he basically gave me some TRW subcontracted work. I'm now reading from my notes. He gives me some TRW subcontracted work on WFBIC assisted scenarios for planetary targets. In other words, TRW had in hand some work relating to moving to planetary targets, but either because they were not directly tasked to do so through their requirements process,
right,
or because they knew about it and had decided not to do anything about it. Anyway, they were ignoring that work. Ed Groth said he'd like me to write some algorithms on it. And Jim Westfall came up to me and said that I should go prod Aaron Guha and Ann Merwarth, basically to assist him in a crusade that he was on. He realized immediately that it was relevant to what I was saying about the shortcomings.
Yeah, to assist whom on it?
To assist him, Jim Westfall, with those two people to assure that the correct epoch of a picture accompany that picture down from the telescope. Now, the subtlety here is that you need to include, the only thing you can get in the OSS is what gets sent down in the science data stream.
Right.
And so when that picture comes up in the OSS, it needs to have accompanying it the information, the definite information about when it took place, when the shutter actually opened. And that is somewhat uncertain, depending on how you command the picture. in other words, the commanded time for taking the picture may not be the actual time of taking the picture. And what you need is the actual time that picture was taken to be able to take the information in it and make future pointing plans based on it.
So he was trying to get this stripped out of the stream and get into science.
I think his particular, I'm not sure of all the subtleties in this timing thing.
Yeah.
Checking with him would be very useful. But I think his strategy at that time was to get that information encoded into the picture. A lot of the WFPIC ancillary information is encoded into unused pixels in the WFPIC picture, and so could be decoded in that way. In other words, you know you're going to get the picture. So his philosophy was put information into that picture in places where it's not being used. So that was the approach. So that tells you when that happened. Basically, the statement was that things just fell through the cracks. And I'm sure that my notes from here on probably track that, the progress of that thing. Now, my purpose in looking that up was to give you some real-time reactions on the people that should have had responsibility at that time and should have done something. And basically, that was the message from everyone. It just, nobody thought it through. And that is one of the most appalling recollections I will carry away from this project. The Science Working Group has on it a number of planetary scientists, including the former project scientist, who's one of Bob Odell's research interests is comets. Jim Westfall is a planetary observer. John Caldwell is a planetary scientist. Jack Brandt is interested in comets. Those guys were sitting on that science working group for years, often with the intent, in some of the cases, their only intent was to use the ST for observing planets. And they were presented technical information, continuing technical reports on the development of the project. And apparently none of them gave any questioning thought to how the requirements for studying something that's moving in the foreground are being folded in on top of the fixed pointing capabilities. Because if any of them had given thought number one to it, they would have realized that the implementation that was in place, which was a straight linear scan, was completely inadequate for accurate pointing.
Did you ever talk with them about why they hadn't caught this?
No. But it was obvious that they hadn't, and they all admitted they hadn't.
Because all of these people are familiar with doing planetary work on ground-based telescopes where you participate in a lot of active guiding with a paddle.
Absolutely.
And the algorithms which they would use by hand in the cage or in the control room are crudely similar to what has to be done here.
Sure.
And even especially Westfall with his experience in the planetary flight program.
Well, I can tell. I don't have a direct answer to your question. I think it would be very interesting if you went back and in your interviews with those people, you know, raise that at some point and find out what their reading on it was. Do you have to change your tape?
I just have to pop this over.
Go ahead.
Let me do that real quick. Going to side two.